Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. So we'll get going here whenever Brian behind the glass decides to push the button. It's up to him.
Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, the podcast where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for being here on this Tuesday or whenever you happen to listen to this podcast. But it is the day on which we do a deep dive into a single topic. And today, you know, we didn't plan it this way when we planned to do this episode. But for my money, anyway, part of the reason to do this today is just to give us all a little mental break from the news. Well, me, maybe. And maybe it's not everybody. From the news out of Afghanistan. And what we're going to talk about is coming out of, or more accurately, dealing with the very long tail of this pandemic, because some workers are back in offices, some are not, kids are back in school, there's masks, there's all kinds of stuff. And honestly, I think it's a tad fraught. That's what I think.
It is fraught. And there's this kind of free-floating anxiety that our guest wrote about, which we're going to talk about in a minute, but that is related to this sense of whiplash that in a, you know, you could say that this administration had its mission accomplished moment, and it was not. And so now there's a question of, you know, are we having hot back summer or is school going to close again? And it's making us all a little bit crazy. Let's say
a little bit nice tying up of many news threads there with the whole Mission Impossible, Mission Accomplished thing and all that jazz. Anyway,
it's all of a happened piece. Before there, and will happen yeah, again, apparently.
Only one story. Anyway, so how should we go about all this? How should we think about it? And what do we do? What do we do? Anyway, yeah. Amy Cuddy is online. She's a social psychologist. Also, she teaches at the business school at Harvard's executive education program. Amy, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It's kind of strange to hear that this is an escape from the news.
Well, you know, I know. I'm not sure I'm on board with that,
about
but
this
okay.
week.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I hear you though.
It's that kind of week.
It is.
Yep, exactly.
So look, let me just like generically start with, is it weird to be stressed about all of this terrible stuff kind of seeming to end or wind down?
Not at all. And I mean, it's interesting because I started to work on this piece on, you know, what I call pandemic flux syndrome, in early July before the big Delta spike. So, and people were already kind of going back into this sort of depressive, anxious stage as we were reemerging. Now, this is another twist in the plot that makes things even more complex psychologically, but I think it's very common for people to be experiencing spikes in whatever they tend toward, whether that's anxiety or sort of depression. And along with that, to have a desire to escape. And if you are more on the depressive kind of melancholic side, that means kind of wanting to shut down for a while, like hide under a weighted blanket and, you know, put on headphones. If you're more on the anxious side, I'm seeing a lot of people who are wanting to make major life changes, like I have to move or change my job or, you know, like something really drastic. And all of that is about a desire to escape this feeling of uncertainty and threat.
I mean, I feel like I read your piece actually toward the end of vacation and it resonated with me so much. And I'm so glad that our producers had already suggested having you on because there's so much value in understanding that you are not alone in these feelings and that, in fact, when we thought things were going to open up and that the mission had been accomplished, there was a lot of stress associated with that, like the first stages of grieving what had happened or even missing lockdown. But then this sense of like fear and lockdown came right back around. Like, can you talk about how it was a little more about how it was those two sort of conflicting waves of intense emotion crashing?
And let me, absolutely. So just to kind of set the context in mid-June, so between June 14th and the 21st, Gallup did a poll. They asked a couple of questions about, they call them like sort of life thriving questions. They've been doing this for 13 years. And in mid-June, that number, so the number of people polled in about 5,000 Americans, almost 60% felt optimistic about the present and future. So they were classified as thriving. Now, in mid-June, it was sort of, you know, the heady early days of summer when we were really thinking we were going to reemerge, hadn't yet quite done it. We were really looking forward to doing the things that we had missed, like going to concerts or going out to dinner with friends. You know, and then all of a sudden, well, I think the 4th of July comes along, and that is, you know, I think of that as a sort of unofficial marker of full-fledged summer, right, in the U.S. And people first weren't as happy as they thought they'd be. So I started getting emails from friends saying, I don't know what's wrong with me. Like, I went out to dinner with friends. I went to a concert. I went to a sporting event. And why am I not happier? What's wrong with me? Why do I want to retreat back home? A lot of those reactions. And that's about a couple of things. One is that we're not very good at predicting our emotions in the future, predicting how we'll feel about future events. And we call these affective forecasting errors. Wow. You know, we don't forecast our affect well. And that's in negative cases and positive cases. So in this case, you know, where we thought I'm going to be euphoric when I socialize, when I emerge, and then you're not, that's an affective forecasting error. So generally, we overestimate the intensity and the duration of our emotions after big single events, discounting all of the other things that are affecting our mood, right? So people think they'll be much happier after a sporting event win for their team than they are and for much longer. And they think they'll be much more upset after our breakup and for much longer than they are, right? Sorry. But I think that was part of what was happening, is that affective forecasting error.
How long
on
does
top
that,
of it?
Sorry, go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say that the second piece there, and this is relevant, I think, even more broadly, is that this is a long. This has been a long crisis, right? This is compared to many other sort of humanitarian crises, this one has gone on a long time, and the way that we deal with crises is, we first go into this kind of emergency phase, and we use what psychologists refer to as surge capacity. And that's this network of psychological and physical systems that help us adapt and deal with acutely stressful situations. But we can't do that for long. That gets depleted. And we then go into this regression phase where we withdraw, we get sad, agitated, we don't want to hang out with people, we're done with Zoom meetings, right? And that's where we are trying to reach charge. And so that went on for so long that our nervous systems are depleted. They're kind of wrecked right now. And so it's not surprising that we don't have the capacity to feel intense positive emotions right now when we go out to that live concert.
So how long is that going to last? I mean, you're talking short, right? I mean, you're talking short term here, I think, but in like 5 years, granted, there are going to be systemic and societal impacts of this pandemic that are going to be generational probably. But like on an individual basis, when does it end?
It's going to vary from person to person, but I do think that the silver lining is that when you look at data over the last year and a half, people are actually on average coping pretty well. Yes, we had this downward turn this summer, but on average, people are quite resilient. Like, our emotional immune systems are pretty good. So we will return to our baseline levels more quickly than we expect to. But I do think that we need to first acknowledge that a lot of people are feeling bad, and they feel guilty to talk about it. Because on the one hand, you know, many, many more people are vaccinated. We are moving toward reopening. And they feel kind of, there's a sense of shame that they don't feel better. In fact, some people were really taking comfort in some of the new routines that they had picked up. You know, they felt that they were moving at a slower pace of life and that worked better for them. And they're not really ready to go back into, you know, full-blown interactions in the workplace. So I think that you know, we need to kind of acknowledge all of these different things that are happening for people, that there's some differences in how people are dealing with them. And at the same time, maintain that sense of optimism that's based in, you know, decades and decades of data that people are actually pretty psychologically resilient.
Right. But I wonder how we can use some of that understanding about these forecasting errors to maybe the second time that we open up or, yep, you know, mm-hmm, resume for real, mm-hmm, or maybe the third time, like every time that we have a setback and then a restart, could we re-examine, and by we, I mean companies, employers, you know, society, re-examine the things that we actually thought were great before, yeah, we had this like big reset about our lives? Like maybe we, yeah, never liked going out to restaurants. I don't know.
Right. And I think that gets at sort of the sort of fourth prong of this, which is that a big part of what's happening now, and which is why it was about sort of, I wanted it to be pandemic vacillation syndrome, but that's a little bit too long, pandemic flux syndrome. It is that there is so much, there's been so much uncertainty, right? And so much, like you said, whiplash. It's like being on a tilt-a-whirl, right, at an amusement park. And that uncertainty about when it ends, exactly what is the threat? The threat keeps changing. How do we fight the threat? All of that uncertainty makes us feel very powerless, right? So we lose our sense of personal power, of agency, of autonomy. And I think that employers are going to have to find ways to help people rediscover that sense of autonomy and agency. And part of that is going to be by listening to kind of what they learned about themselves over the last 18 months, about what works for them. I'm seeing that the companies that seem to be less susceptible to this, what are they calling it? The massive resignation trend that we're seeing, yeah, the ones that seem to be doing better are the ones that are offering employees more flexible ways to return to work and really listening to what works for them. So I do think that understanding that the uncertainty has robbed us of our sense of power, and to restore power, you're going to need to give people some flexibility, some choice in how they return to work. I think that's a smart move for leaders.
Okay, but and as we all know, just by reading the news, and certainly some of us living through it in our own companies, they can't decide what they want to do with requiring vaccinations, when to come back to work, all of those things. And it seems to me they might have a tougher time with the softer skills that you seem to be saying they will have to employ here.
Yeah. I mean, sort of welcome to the world of being a psychologist, right, talking to people in business.
Right.
Although I am always.
But there's still people.
Yes.
There's still people. They had the same experience that, you know, I did.
Yeah. And some of them are actually doing it well. And so I think one, it will, you know, we do, and I know there are all these frustrating pieces about how we keep saying we need more data, but we do quickly need to be collecting data on what's working in organizations around this, like to be able to show, like to make the business case for why it's better to be flexible with your employees and to listen to them. That's certainly the most compelling thing that you can do to get to change how people sort of lead. But, you know, I think that beginning by acknowledging that people are struggling, I feel like in a way employers are afraid to say it because they're afraid that somehow it makes it more real, but it's already real. And people find it they feel so seen and understood. They feel so relieved to hear, oh my gosh, I'm not alone and I'm not going to lose my job because I'm feeling bad right now. Right. So like you said, you know, that's, I think Kai, you said that at the beginning, that just sort of the acknowledgement, or Molly, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I'm not sure which of you said that, acknowledging it, is that alone is so important.
Yeah.
Right. Does it come down to, you know, it's interesting. I'm thinking about it now at the business level, and it sort of feels like there's probably a lot of fear in admitting that the way things were before might not work going forward, because that feels like the first step in just undoing the mm-hmm. whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like it
slope.
Just yeah. feels yeah. safer yeah. to pretend it was always working great.
Exactly. It's and that's the, you know, it's funny. I have a bit of trouble with the word resilience, because, you know, when you look at really what resilience means, it's about an object sort of returning to its original shape after being, you know, distorted by some stimulus. And we're not going to return to our normal shape, you know, to our pre-COVID mm-hmm. shape. It's going to be a bit different. And so I do like the idea of agility better, to focus on the ability to adapt to these changing times, without fear. But what you see also is to move past that regression stage that I was referring to earlier into what we call recovery or rebuilding. That does take some effortful, you know, thoughtful work from leaders. And there are a few things that they can do. One that seems to work is to have a day one, a new day one. It's like a fresh start day. Now, as we see, COVID's not going to end in a clear way. It's not going to be, you know, where we're all celebrating in the streets and it's, yeah. you know, over a shared enemy. But an organization can say, this is going to be our day one. So people get to kind of restart. Another thing that helps is to reorient people around new goals. You know, maybe it's interesting. Like some companies have thrived, some industries have thrived financially, but still their employees are not happy. Those leaders are the most confused when I talk to them. I don't understand. We've done so well, but they're so stressed out. They're not happy. What do we do? Right. So reorienting them around new goals, getting them focused on something else to renew that sense of purpose. Also restructuring teams, because teams, you know, teams in this virtual environment struggle. It's tough for them to connect with each other. Mm-hmm. And so then you get some kind of bad vibes between people, some broken trust, broken relationships, and sometimes you just need to reorganize teams. But it's going to, you know, leaders are going to have to guide people in that with a combination of sensitivity and compassion and optimism.
Hmm. Love it. Amy Cuddy is a social psychologist who teaches at Harvard Business School's Executive Education Program. Amy, thank you so much. I feel seen.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thanks for having me. Love you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're gonna take a quick break here in a minute. Let us know what you're thinking, would you? If you're going through some of those things that Amy and Molly and I talked about, let us know. And let us know how you're dealing with it. Because look, as Molly and I have shared on this podcast many a time, sometimes we're not dealing with it so well, you know?
I know, exactly. And the only outlet we have is this show.
Is you guys, yeah.
And maybe the occasional kind of crappy gardening. So tell us how you are coping as this flux syndrome. It's real. It's real. It's real. And if anything, I hope you feel acknowledged by that. You can send us a voice memo or an email to makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can also call us and leave us a voice message. Our new number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UBSMART. We'll be right back.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
And we're back. And it's time for a quick news fix.
We are back. All right. I'll climb in and just go real quick first. And I'll say this will probably be the last time I try to mention Afghanistan on this podcast, just because I'm becoming news overwhelmed. But I want to make sure that people are aware of this reporting that the Washington Post did 2 years ago now in a series of really great investigative reports, which were basically the Afghanistan papers, analogous to the Pentagon papers of the Vietnam War. It's a bunch of reporting that the Post did, basically laying out in detail how the American government knew that this was an unwinnable war, that things were not going to end well, and yet on we kept going, and on we kept messaging to the American public that the Afghan military could handle it. So we're going to put this link on our show page. It's A Secret History of the War, the Afghanistan Papers, in the Washington Post from 2 years ago. And all y'all, check it out, because it's just, it's, look, I've been clear. I think this is just a terrible ending to a very sad chapter of this country's expeditionary forces. Anyway, that's it.
I read today, actually, I just dropped it in our Slack because it's going to end up in the show notes probably. I just read, actually, the Washington Post did a piece about Barbara Lee.
Oh, yeah.
Who was the only member of Congress after 9/11 to vote against the war in Afghanistan, specifically against the broad authorization that was used to carry out that war, which is what led the Bush administration to be able to say, you know what? Now that we like caught bin Laden and toppled al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, we're just going to stay.
Yeah.
We're going to expand the mission to this kind of like nation building thing that is what really became the morass. Like the first part already took 10 years and it was 10 more years of this campaign that was enabled by this authorization that only Barbara Lee, representative from California, voted against. She got death threats. You know, she was called a traitor. And she has spent all of the intervening time since introducing legislation to roll back that exact type of authorization that lets presidents basically prosecute any war they want and, you know, let all their buddies profit.
And oh, it's by the way, the AUMF, it's called the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, AUMF from 2001, is still in force. And it's what every president since George Bush has used every time they use force. And the Congress cannot take it upon itself to make the difficult decisions to withdraw these permissions. It's kind of amazing. Yeah. Kind of amazing.
Yep. And she's still at it.
She's still there.
Trying to get this repealed. I mean, it really, like, these are the mistakes. Let's, you know, let's for once maybe learn from this mistake, because this is why this keeps happening.
Yep.
This kind of thing. And it's a tragedy every time. It's just appalling and infuriating.
Yep.
I will commend to you, actually, a little thread from my erstwhile beat from the tech world, because I just think that I thought it was so interesting. Brian Fung from CNN did a bunch of reporting and then a bunch of tweeting about, ironically, about how social media now is trying to deal with the Taliban takeover. Mm-hmm. Because according to not the State Department, but the Treasury Department, the Afghan Taliban is listed as a specially designated global terrorist entity. And so all of a sudden, social media, almost as quickly as the United States government, is like, oh, crap, they're in charge. Now what do we do? Facebook has said that, you know, the Taliban's been banned for years. YouTube, like, took 3 days to try to figure out a plan and then finally wrote back to Brian Fung and said, no, yeah, totally, yep, because of the Treasury thing, they're off. Twitter seems to have no idea what to do. And then all of them are going to run into their own kind of weird arbitrary rules about world leaders and notable figures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of part of, I don't know, I just thought it was really interesting that it speaks to that fact that kind of no one knows what to do.
Nobody knows what to do. Nobody does.
And then my totally non-Afghanistan mention today is actually about, the Bloomberg had this remarkable piece that came out yesterday, a big, big, big graphic, it came out a week ago, but it was a big graphic representation of how Mackenzie Scott, the former wife of Jeff Bezos, is just like dropping philanthropy bombs left and right. Yeah. She's, you know, given out almost or announced at least $8.6 billion in gifts. She is outspending the Gates and the Ford Foundations combined.
Wow.
She is reshaping the nonprofit world. And the thing that I wanted to point out is that of that money, $25 million of the almost $9 billion pledged has gone to environmental causes.
Wait, say that again.
$25 million.
That doesn't sound like that much money.
Yeah,
okay.
It's not.
All right, yeah.
It is like the tiniest little chunk. And there have been articles for years asking, and let me put this subtly from insidephilanthropy.com since 2015, where the hell is all the philanthropy spending on climate? 2017, the Hewlett Foundation, why philanthropy must do more on climate change. I spoke to the Gates Foundation, I don't know, 6 or 7 months ago about, you know, because Bill Gates wrote this climate book, like, hey, what are you guys actually doing around there? I'm here to tell you, like, nothing. Had the entire engines of philanthropy turned their attention to this cause, and no, it is not philanthropy's problem to solve alone. But at a moment when a person is making like these massive waves in philanthropic giving, truly transforming huge sectors, almost zero of that money on a relative basis is being spent on environmental issues and climate change.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yep.
It's amazing.
Learning from our mistakes. That's it for the news fix. Let's do. If she would, you know, ever go on anybody's show, I would ask her directly, but she won't.
She won't. So she doesn't.
Let's do the mailbag.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
So we got an email, a voice memo, actually, from Rob in Seattle. And the backstory that you need to understand where this one's coming from is this. We did an episode a couple of years ago trying to figure out why the cost of college is just so completely confusing, right? Because nobody pays full freight for a whole lot of reasons. Well, except international students, but that's a whole different podcast. Anyway, Rob sent us a voice memo back then, a couple of years ago, telling us about how he was getting ready to send his twin sons to college and how he was planning to pay for it. Here's the update.
Now here we are. 2021, they graduated last year. Learned a couple things along the way. One is that scholarships made themselves available over the course of their studies. We didn't anticipate that. The other thing is that there are certain expenses like private apartments that are not eligible for a payment from 529 funds. So only checks that you write to the institutions are eligible for 529 funds. Please note, parents out there. So keep up the great work. Still loving the show.
Yeah, the morass that is. Yeah, no, go ahead, because I've been down this road. So you're learning things here. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, that should get fixed. I'm sorry. Like, housing is kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
And if parents are socking away money for years and years and years in their 529s to help pay for college and housing is not part of that, if it's off campus, that's absurd. But also, how awesome that we got an update from Rob in Seattle like 4 years later.
Years later. Yeah. Yeah.
That's so amazing.
Yep.
Oh, I love our show.
Good stuff.
That's outstanding. All right. Thanks, Rob. Thanks for continuing to listen to our show all these years later and also keeping us up to date. And congrats to you and your boys. That's amazing.
Yeah,
Or your twins. I can't remember, I guess, if you said they were boys. Yeah, twin sons. Anyway, this next voice memo is for you, Kai.
Okay.
Hi, this is Natalie calling from Davenport, Florida.
Hi, Natalie.
I was originally going to submit this as a What Do You Want to Know Wednesday question, because as I was listening to the Economics Untapped last Friday and Kai was talking about being in his shed, I thought, oh, I wonder how Kai's internet is holding up. And then, like, 2 seconds after that thought came into my mind, Kai's internet did not hold up. And so what started out as a What Do I Want to Know Wednesday ended up being into a Make Me Smile moment. So
go.
Thank you, Kai. And I'm sorry your internet still is not working.
Yeah.
Y'all have a great day.
I don't even know. I can't even with the internet provider in my hometown. It's just nuts.
Maybe Natalie caused it.
Maybe.
Just a tiny bit. Maybe she manifested
asking
it.
That
Natalie
question?
Is a nexus.
Holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no.
Natalie's
so I get to come down to the abandoned studios at Marketplace World headquarters every single day, which, you know, is not so bad. It's not so bad.
I think Kai's internet is down would be great premium fundraising swag. That'd be a pretty awesome t-shirt. You know how I love a random t-shirt.
Yes, totally true. All right. One more voice memo. Here it is, and it's about going back to work.
Hey, smart folks. This is Beth calling from New York City, where in the before times, I worked backstage in the wardrobe department on a Broadway show. I'm very pleased that our employers are going to be requiring us all to get vaccinated, because there's no way I can do a quick change with an actor from 6 feet away. It's just not going to happen. And my union has said, yes, your employer is going to be requiring this, and we're not going to fight that because that's not the hill we want to die on, literally. Have a good, smart day.
Yeah, totally.
Yep. Thanks for sharing, Beth. To all of the companies out there who are sort of waiting to see what everyone else is going to do.
Don't wait. Why are you waiting? Why are you waiting?
Do right.
Why?
By
do
your
the
people.
Right thing. Do the right thing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Tell us, by the way, what else is going on with your workplaces? We would love to know more. Are you going back? Are you staying home? Is your employer trying to not make waves by waiting to see what everyone else is going to do? How do you feel about it? Let us know. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. Or, of course, call us, 508-UBSMART, S-M-A-R-T.
All right. Leave you, as we always do, with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, later found out you were wrong about? Go.
Hi, this is Ben Vickers from Cave Creek, Arizona. Something I thought I knew but later found out I was wrong about was tequila. After a ill-advised 20-something bout with the drink, I wrote it off as disgusting swill, but then thanks to you guys, I tried a tanga for the first time. Oh, right back on the tequila train.
Oh,
thanks for making us all smart.
Welcome back, friends.
Man.
Welcome back. Welcome back. So,
oh, my God.
I credit my good friend Salisa for, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, you know, we were hanging out and she ordered a reposado over ice. And I was like, wait, tequila can be good and also classy? And that reintroduced me to the world of tequila, which is delightful. Welcome back, Ben.
Oh, my
Glad
goodness.
We could help in ways big and small.
Oh, my Lord. There we go. All right. So, look, send us your answers or random anecdotes that fit in along the lines of what is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about. Voice memos can come to us in our emails from your phones or a voice message at our new phone number, 508-82-SMART. Hook us up, would you? Let us know what's on your minds.
Hook us up.
Oh, man.
You know, if you can help just one person any way whatsoever,
that's exactly right.
We'll take it. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by the wonderful Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Our intern is Grace Rubin.
Brian Allison engineered in the moment today. Juan Carlos Torrado is going to mix it later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer was Bridget Bodner. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. And there you go.
Wah, wah, wah.
There you go.
2%, by the way.
2% what?
2% of philanthropic giving goes to
climate. That's insane. That's
issues.
Crazy.
It's insane! That's crazy. This is my new obsession. Maybe we should do a whole show on it.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.